Today is Wednesday, November 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, new developments in the special counsel's Russia investigation.
So when you have somebody who is consistently saying something that isn't true, it makes everything else he says suspect.
The largest U.S. automaker's decision to close plants and lay off workers is angering the president. Will the U.S. and China be able to strike a deal to end the trade war? Also ahead, a successful pop star who's had a number of personal problems releases a new Christmas album. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, staunchly denies ever meeting with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange after the Guardian newspaper published a report alleging the two met at least three times, including once in 2016. Manafort's statement came one day after special counsel Robert Mueller's office told a federal judge that Manafort had breached his plea agreement by lying repeatedly to the FBI, despite pledging to cooperate with the probe. In the same court filing, Manafort denied it. Prosecutors said they plan to file a report before sentencing, laying out the alleged crimes Manafort committed after pleading guilty in September. The surprise development came as Mueller is working toward finalizing a report on his probe into whether Russia and Trump's campaign colluded in the 2016 presidential election. Joining us to discuss, criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. How unusual is it for someone to make a plea deal and then cooperate with lies?
It's unusual at this point. When you look at where he is right now, it's the worst of all worlds, because you had a deal in place, you blow the deal, and you were better off going to trial in the first place and saying nothing and then fighting your outcome. Now what you have is admissions, so they have the convictions in place, and the potential is for something far, 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 far worse than anything you would have seen before. Let's take it one step further. Not only are we looking at him being sentenced on the original charges, they could actually recharge him with the remaining charges that had a hung jury and with the new charges that were still pending in Washington, D.C. We're not even talking about what's going on in New York State. So there's a whole series of things that are sitting out there waiting for Paul Manafort, which could potentially result in Paul Manafort being in prison for the rest of his life.
There's a lot of speculation about this. What would cause the special counsel to rip up a deal that benefited his investigation? So he obviously must feel like, you know, the lies were not getting him anywhere. But since it is so unusual for someone to make a plea deal, as Manafort did, to potentially cooperate and reduce his jail time, there's speculation that I've been hearing, I'm wondering what your legal opinion is, that maybe the president may have dangled a pardon in front of him, so he is counting on that.
It's actually not that unusual to see a plea deal in federal court, because the sentencing guidelines are so draconian that what could happen to them are so brutal that they're going to try to find a way to avoid that. But the idea that what you would do is blow this deal yourself and then roll the dice for what the judge can do, plus what the Mueller investigation could do on the new set of charges that are still sitting out there, make it really, really unusual. The idea that you would do this with just that hope strikes me as odd at best. At the same time, this idea of a pardon from the president, where you're depending upon the president to actually follow through with something that he might like to do, might want to do, is also a bit of a stretch at this point, because I'm not so sure I would be confident that the president would actually do what he said he was going to do unless it just suited him. At the same time, this president has pardoned people who would have driven conservatives to be apoplectic in the past. So the idea that he would actually pardon someone like a Paul Manafort wouldn't exactly be shocking.
Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani was asked about it and said that he wouldn't rule out a pardon from Trump. But could Trump face some problems in and of himself if he were to pardon Manafort?
Yes. Actually, there's a couple of things that could happen if you look at the possibility of this. First of all, think about it this way. You have somebody who's actually cooperating with the Fed. You actually had a lawyer go in and say, stop cooperating and we'll actually pardon you. That's actually witness tampering. That's actually a crime. So you're actually facing potential criminal activity. And if the president were involved, he would be equally responsible for that issue. You also have the question of disbarment. If you're a lawyer getting involved in those sorts of negotiations, because you're literally trying to stop a witness from speaking to the Fed about something. So if they were to do this, it really opens them up on that side. At the same time, if they were doing this kind of a negotiation, I think this would trigger immediately an impeachment impeachment proceeding against the president.
The Guardian is reporting that Mr. Manafort met on several occasions before and during the presidential campaign when he became Mr. Trump's campaign chair, met with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. That would sort of implicate him in collaborating maybe with these emails of Hillary Clinton's. We don't have confirmation about this story, but if it were to be true and it did happen, would it be possible that he didn't tell the president, that the president wasn't aware that this collaboration was going on? And how much of a problem could this be for the president?
This could be a real problem for the president. This ties a direct link between the Russians and Julian Assange. Julian Assange and Paul Manafort, who is the chairman of the president's election team, and the president himself. This is just a couple of steps removed that go right into the potential, anyway, Oval Office. And so that's as tight as you may actually get. Is that enough to actually bring an indictment? That is the huge question, but it is a massive deal.
That's criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping could reach a new trade deal between the world's two largest economies when they meet in Argentina this weekend. That's what White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow said Tuesday after he spoke with President Trump.
We want a world, ideally, of zero tariffs, zero non-tariff barriers, and zero subsidies.
U.S. and China over several months have imposed tit-for-tat tariffs on hundreds of billions of dollars of imports arriving from each other's shores. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Mark Bush, professor of international business diplomacy at Georgetown University.
That would certainly be encouraging. And the question, of course, is much like Kudlow said, how to deal with some of the caveats attached to that proposition. So the goal seems to be, and perhaps it's a loftier goal than just whatever could happen in the G20 meeting, zero tariffs, zero non-tariff barriers, and zero subsidies. That's certainly a nice aspirational goal, but the question is, in the short term, and especially with respect to intellectual property, what are the markers of success? And that will be key in any meeting that happens in Argentina. Markers for success and timelines on those markers with respect to intellectual property in China.
What do you think that both Donald Trump and Xi Jinping must do, and how far can they each go to reach some kind of a settlement?
Well, the problem is that, as you heard Mr. Kudlow discuss in his news conference, the view on the street is that the U.S. economy is piping along, which is largely true. And that is masking the ill effects of some of these trade tariffs. So the problem for the U.S. is that during good economic times, it's almost as though we can have a trade policy that is backfiring and yet not suffer the consequences. For the Chinese, they certainly want out of this. The way forward has to be, and it's useful to try and envision a way forward, this new initiative in China, the Made in China 2020. The fact is that the Chinese are doing some really interesting things that sound like supporting the emergence of technology-based industries. They are already ahead of the U.S. on many things, including artificial intelligence. And it would certainly be useful for the two sides to think of a deal that, in a way, mimicked what the U.S. and the Japanese signed in the 1980s when the two went to war over semiconductors. We are both investing in similar technologies. We should stay away from subsidies that are actionable, and we should share the benefits of government-sponsored R&D.
What is your prediction for Argentina?
Well, both sides are probably going to try and announce something that looks like a good first cut, and both sides are going to hedge their bets and try and save a little face. But my hope is that in the spirit of what just happened with the midterm elections, and as President Trump retools his trade policy to deal with a Democratic House, that in fact what Larry Kudlow said today might actually be quite inspirational going forward. A world with no tariffs, no non-tariffs, and no subsidies. If suddenly President Trump can channel John McCain and move in a pro-trade direction, that would really be terrific, and not just for the United States, for the global economy as a whole.
You think that's what he has had in mind the entire time?
You know, I really wouldn't want to wage that bet, but I'm telling you, the excitement in hearing Kudlow say that line was almost too much to let pass. And I'm not an optimist by nature, but boy, did I like hearing that line, because in truth, this trade policy has been anything but trade enhancing. And it would certainly be nice, as both a political and as an economic effort, for President Trump to retool and potentially inadvertently deliver on one of the most pro-trade agendas that could possibly be true at the current moment. That would be fun, but I won't lead your listeners to think that that's a high likelihood. I'm just speculating, wishing.
Well, on Monday, Trump voiced doubts that a deal could be reached when he meets with the Xi Saturday night in Buenos Aires on the sidelines of the G20 summit of the world's largest economies. Trump has threatened to impose more tariffs on Chinese exports if the two sides cannot reach what he considers fairer trading between the two countries. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Indian police halt their efforts to retrieve the body of an American killed by a secluded tribe. An ex-official from Venezuela sentenced to a decade in a U.S. prison. Syrian women are seeking a role in drafting their constitution. And Tunisians stage the first Arab protests against visiting Saudi crown prince. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The largest U.S. automaker says it's halting production of 5 plants in North America and laying off thousands of workers. The company said Monday it's also ending production of 6 vehicles, including the electric hybrid Chevy Volt. President Trump is warning GM it could face consequences. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow says the administration's not happy with GM.
Obviously, there's a lot of disappointment, even anger.
Even as Kudlow and other officials were briefing reporters, the president was tweeting his own disappointment, referring to the government bailing out GM and other automakers 10 years ago and tweeting, "This is the thanks we get." He says the White House is looking at cutting all subsidies for GM, and he blasted its chief for closing plants in Michigan, Ohio, and Maryland, even though, in his words, nothing was being closed in Mexico and China. Sagar Magani at the White House.
And joining us now to talk more about why GM is making these changes and what it might mean is Marina Wittman. She is a professor emerita of business administration at the University of Michigan, and she was a chief economist and first female vice president at General Motors. GM chief executive Mary Barra spoke to the president over the weekend to discuss the cuts and was at the White House Monday to meet with economic advisor Larry Kudlow. What do you think is her reasoning for these plant closures?
It's entirely consistent with Mary Barra's style of operation. She has always been less concerned with bigness and more concerned with profitability. And she has not hesitated to cut operations in other countries where they simply haven't been making money. And she ended GM in Europe. She ended GM in Australia. That was called Holden's. The whole auto industry is caught in an interesting bind where they have to provide the vehicles that people want to buy now. And at the same time, they have to be investing for what's coming in the future, which is, of course, autonomous vehicles and all electric vehicles. So this is a somewhat complicated transition for them. And what I think has motivated Mary is that the market is something of a surprise. Americans just don't seem to want to buy sedans anymore. Now, a couple of years ago, there was a lot of talk about how with high gasoline prices, people wanted fuel efficiency more than they had in the past. And the way it turns out at the moment is that people still are more concerned with comfort and convenience than with fuel efficiency. So the market has shifted in this country quite substantially away from sedans and all the plants she's talking about. And GM is going to stop making sedans, as far as I can tell, in this country. At the same time, you have all this changing technology where cars are not going to be fully autonomous, I think, for quite a while. But you're getting things like dynamic cruise control, warnings that you're straying off your lane, a whole variety of things. The driver is still in control, but the car is giving some pretty strong suggestions. So Mary is responding to this change in the market. The change in technology requires substantial investment for the automobiles of the future, the all-electric and the autonomous. And although GM has done a pretty good job of cutting costs, there have been some cost increases, and certainly some of them due to the tariffs on aluminum and steel.
What are the Trump tariffs, or the Trump administration's tariffs on aluminum and steel, doing to the auto industry? Has that been a factor in what is happening with GM?
As I understand it, it is not the major factor. That probably these market shifts and the investments for the future are more important. But there's no question that these aluminum and steel tariffs are raising the cost of building a car and of building many of the components. The fact is that so far the tariffs haven't hit hard enough to affect the country in a macro sense. They certainly are raising costs for quite a number of industries. And the irony is that, as I understand it, Trump was trying to arrange the tariffs so they wouldn't hit consumers. Well, if you don't hit consumers, you must be hitting producers. And that's the story we're getting from quite a few industries. It is affecting their costs.
What do you think about the latest comments, or I should say threats, the president on Tuesday? He basically threatened to cut all General Motors subsidies after the announcement of thousands of jobs.
Yeah,
cuts.
Well, he's given to threats, and a few of them do come to fruition. Many of them don't. I, frankly, have been gone from the industry long enough that I'm not familiar in detail with what subsidies he's talking about.
General Motors said they weren't clear on what subsidies he was talking about.
Yeah, well, if General Motors isn't clear, you can bet that I'm not clear. My guess is that General Motors is not going to be responsive to these threats.
Do you think the cuts are necessary to sustain the company?
Yeah. I mean, she's certainly the most prescient CEO that GM has had in my life, in my living memory. Frankly, I think she's just a lot better at making rational decisions about the likely future than any CEO I ever dealt with.
Have you been able to hear of anyone directly impacted by this?
But,
I imagine it's pretty devastating.
Yeah. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people whose lives are being very unpleasantly affected by this, and some of them will not be able to get jobs as good as the ones that they've lost. And unfortunately, the United States is not as generous as most other developed countries are, or industrialized countries, in assisting people with these kinds of transitions. I mean, this is a big transition. And of course, if you have those, a country or an economy never moves on. But the fact is that they can hurt a subgroup of people quite hard. And most industrialized countries give some assistance in cushioning that transition for the people who are hit hardest by it. We do a little, but not nearly as much as most countries do.
That's Marina Wittman, former chief economist and first female vice president at General Motors. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
She said she too young, don't want no man.
Starting Monday, November 5th, tune into Border Crossings to win a free copy of Now 68, featuring top songs from a variety of artists. This CD features Calvin Harris's One Kiss, along with Ariana Grande's God is a Woman, and many other hit songs. Tune into Border Crossings to win.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, there are plenty of places to get a cup of coffee in the U.S. city of San Francisco, but a new kind of cafe is offering espressos and cappuccinos made by a robot. Michelle Quinn stopped by to see if a robot can really make a good cafe latte.
Did it just wave at us? There you go. Meet Robin, a robotic barista who can make a cappuccino or five in minutes.
All right.
This robot works at Cafe X, whose slogan is, come for the robot, stay for the coffee. Robin doesn't get tired, doesn't go on breaks, and it makes an Americano exactly the same way each time.
It's always going to use exactly the same quantity of bean, the same milliliters of milk or water, the temperature is going to be the same.
This robot barista is more than a glorified vending machine. It is a combination of hardware and software. A six-axis Mitsubishi arm, algorithms to figure out how to juggle multiple orders, and sensors to detect cups and check on dwindling supplies. Nearby, a human hovers in case there is a problem with the robot and chats with customers about the origins of the coffee beans.
We sort of really see this as a human-robot collaboration. You know, how can you enhance the productivity of an existing barista?
And the robots have been programmed to have a little personality.
So we have a wave, which is very popular. People really like to see the robot wave. We also have a sort of voila kind of gesture, being like, hey, here's your coffee. Our V2 machine does little dances in between to try to attract passersby.
And how do customers feel about robot coffee?
I feel like this is a level I'm comfortable with, and I don't know about any more than that.
I think there's a lot of repetitive work that people would not want to do. At the same time, I think robots need a tremendous amount of human interaction to get it to the point where it can make a cup of coffee. So
this cafe presents a vision of collaboration. Working robots and human workers coming together around coffee. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, San Francisco.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists from the universities of Scotland and Kent studied and analyzed some of the world's oldest cave paintings at sites in Turkey, Spain, France, and Germany. They say their investigations reveal that rather than just being primitive depictions of humans and animals, the ancient cave art actually suggests that people from as far back as 40,000 years ago had comparatively advanced knowledge of astronomy than had been thought. The Scottish and English researchers say the animals depicted in the ancient art are actually symbolic representations of star constellations, which were used to signify dates and designate occasions such as comet strikes. The researchers, who detailed their findings in a study published by the Athens Journal of History, say this astronomical knowledge could have helped ancient mariners navigate the open seas, something that could have impacted migration paths of prehistoric humans. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, Steven Hillenburg, who created the Nickelodeon show of the undersea world of SpongeBob SquarePants, has died of Lou Gehrig's disease. AP correspondent Oscar Wells Gabriel has details.
Who lives in a pineapple under the sea?
You don't have to be a kid to know the answer to that question. And that was the beauty of Bikini Bottom, the animated underwater habitat where SpongeBob SquarePants and his buddies live. The creator of that character has died. Steven Hillenburg was 57. He had Lou Gehrig's disease. Hillenburg said that SpongeBob was spawned by his love of drawing and his love of marine biology. That love grew into a beloved empire. There are nearly 250 episodes in the animated series. It went on to win 4 Emmys, 5 Kids' Choice Awards, and launched an endless line of merchandise. I'm Oscar Wells Gabriel.
Well, it's the time of year when a number of singers release Christmas-themed songs. VOA Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with details about a new recording from a very successful artist.
Today, we're talking about singer Katy Perry, who has topped the Forbes annual list of the highest-paid women in music. Believe it or not, she beat out Taylor Swift, Beyoncé, all those folks. Katy Perry's income this past 12 months was $83 million. Last year, Taylor Swift earned over $100 million and topped the list. This time, she moves down to number 2 on their annual list. But Katy made $83 million. Taylor made $80 million. Katy's money this year came from the sales of her latest album, which is album number 5 in her collection, Witness, plus the Witness tour that she was on for the last year or so, and the $25 million that ABC TV paid her to return to American Idol as a judge for the reboot of the show, which took place earlier this year and will continue in 2019. As I understand, American Idol is going to be back on, but not until January 2019. Now, Katy Perry celebrated a milestone in her career not too long ago. She marked the 10th anniversary of her very first song, I Kissed a Girl. And also, within the last few weeks, she celebrated the anniversary of her very first number one hit, which came in 2008, called Hot and Cold. And since 2008, Katy has collected 11 number one hits in her career. Today, we're celebrating another first. We're going to listen to the very first Christmas song from Katy Perry. This is called Cozy Little Christmas.
Everybody's in a hurry, in a flurry, shopping till they're dropping in the snow. Kids are crying, dogs are barking, catching up with folks we barely know. Sure, it's madness, but it's magic. As soon as you hang up the mistletoe, 'cause you're the reason for the season. But we don't need to keep up with the Joneses. Our love is something priceless. I don't need diamonds, no sparkles.
It's interesting, Larry, how some singers, some performers decide to record Christmas albums, Christmas music.
Well, they want to remain relevant. And Katy has stopped touring. The Witness tour is over. She, by her own decision, has been laying very low since the tour ended. She said she wants to just kind of think about life, think about herself. You know, this hasn't been easy for Katy Perry because she grew up as the daughter of two ministers. And they were very opposed to her going into pop music. In fact, her very first album was a gospel album, which didn't do so well. And then her second album became Katy Perry in the Pop World. Her real name is Katy Hudson, by the way. And so she's had some very public breakups. She's dated some high-profile celebrities. She dated John Mayer for a while and a number of others. But, yeah, with the new sound, the new Christmas sound, she wants to stay top of mind because she's not going to be on television again until January when American Idol returns. And she's also been focusing on her relationship with actor Orlando Bloom. The two of them have a very, very hot relationship, shall we say. The two of them are very happy together. They're out in public. There's been no secret about the romance. And Katy has also expressed a desire to do some more acting. She did a very little bit of acting. She's been the voice character of an animated cartoon called The Smurfs, where she was in not one but two of the Smurfs films. In 2012, Katy Perry was named the Billboard Woman of the Year. She remains the top five digital sales artist from America of all time. She sold over 40 million albums, 100 million singles around the world. 2013, she was the top global female artist. She's got four Guinness records, five American Music Awards, a Brit Award, and a Juno Award, and she's not done yet.
No, she sounds very active.
And I love her Christmas song. And as you mentioned, a lot of artists are releasing Christmas songs. She said she has no plans for a Christmas album. This is a one-off. She just wants to get into the Christmas spirit. It's called Cozy Little Christmas.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
Just you and me under a tree. A cozy little Christmas here with you.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.